right now, I'm going to introduce somebody that I think is just fantastic. A new book called Malika has just been issued. It's the biography of Valerie Browning. And Valerie Browning is also an Anglican, like our guest from Anglicare from just a few moments ago. But Valerie is one who's put her faith into practice in the most direct and courageous fashion. Valerie Browning lives the life of a tribal nomad with the pastoral people of the Afar region of the Horn of Africa, one of the most strife-torn and ecologically stressed places on the planet. Well, to learn why this Australian nurse is known as Malika, or Queen of the Afar, stick around. Here's some music from the Afar people from Ethiopia, Hussein Hali and Kasal. Kasal, the music of the Afar people. Hussein Hali is the artist. The album's called Ahiba Boy. It has been brought to us by our guest, Valerie Browning. Valerie's an extraordinary Australian by any measure. As a young nurse from rural New South Wales, she went to Ethiopia in the 1970s, in part as a response to the remarkable journalistic images of the disastrous famine brought to the world so powerfully by Jonathan Dimbleby. What started as a six-month adventure has become a lifetime commitment. In fact, in 1989, Valerie Browning married an Afar man, Ismail, a clan leader who now lives, and Valerie now lives as an Afar woman in northern Ethiopia, perhaps one of the harshest places on earth if you've ever seen images of the Danakil Valley. To the Afar people, Valerie is known as Malika, which in Arabic means queen. Valerie, welcome to the program.
Thank you indeed.
Valerie, that music is so optimistic and open. You get a wondrous sense of that. But when you hear of the conditions in which the Afar people live, perhaps some of the harshest living environment on earth, you've become part of that. How do you explain the paradox of this optimism against that horrific environment?
Well, optimism is a form of survival. I mean, if you're in difficulty, optimism is one of your best weapons. And the Afar are the most funny, fun-loving people you could ever imagine. They love all the arts. They love dancing. They love singing. They love poetry, everything. And they do it spontaneously. And in fact, they don't see their life as particularly difficult. They love their land, they love their environment, and they're very clever with the ecology of their land.
Now, there's another paradox here. You're a Christian woman married to a Muslim Afar man. And indeed, you're not only just a Christian woman by culture, you're a Christian woman by commitment. Is that paradox a difficult one for you to live out?
No. It's not a difficult one for me to live out because I've tried to escape it, and I've screamed and shouted, fallen on the floor in front of God and said, let me out. This is it. I can't stand it longer. And I have seen, and I truly seen, the hand of God say, no, you're not leaving. You are not leaving. And you will continue, and I will give you all you need, so just keep quiet. So it's my whole process has been a magnificent, privileged teaching period. And as a Christian, I've been able to grow enormously in my faith in God within the Muslim society. The Muslim society, I couldn't say they have opposed me in any way. In fact, they have been so generous, so hospitable. They have shown me such amazing respect. Respect is what I could say, which I couldn't have got in Western society, perhaps.
We'll talk about that spiritual journey a little later. Let's talk about the conditions in which the Afar found themselves when you arrived in 1972 and the conditions in which they continue to live. We should explain that the Afar people occupy a region of Africa which is popularly seen as the Horn of Africa, in between three countries, really, Ethiopia, Somalia, Djibouti, and it's been an area of continual physical struggle, political violence and harsh drought for the past 30 years. You've committed yourself to working developmentally with the Afar people. Now, most Westerners would take that as, oh yes, you live in a comfortable house and you go out with sort of on the road in air-conditioned vehicles into the desert and you give people aid and help them with instruction. But it's not like that at all. Tell us a little about what it's like.
Well, to start with, my home and my house is the community's house. So there's plenty of people in that house who've come there for various reasons, some for education, some for health reasons, all sorts. So I'm not alone. I've not got any private space, if you like, or any private anything that you would understand in the West. And going out with the community, we will go as far as we can, perhaps with a vehicle, but beyond that, it is always on foot. The landscape is semi-desert to desert. We don't want to say all desert. And we walk with material on camels or on backpacks on our backs. And we have to go from place to try and find water. The community is very scattered. We live and sleep with the community and we eat whatever the community is eating, which is milk and bread.
So what does it mean in the normal course of life, like sleeping? You sleep in the open? You sleep... Well, what about toiletries? I mean, what do you do for hygiene?
We sleep in the open. There are no toilets, and I don't think there should be toilets in a mobile society like that. So, I mean, you just go off... Afar go up to 2 kilometres to go to the toilet because they have a very strong sense of hygiene. So you go wherever you can, far away and out of the eye of anybody. And it's like that. And
how much of your year would be lived like this?
At least 75%. I've got to come to Addis from time to time to communicate with the rest of the world, but most of my time is in the field, and most of my time when I'm in the field, I'm actually in the rural area.
That can mean walking on foot for how many hours a day through what sort of climate?
We try to start before sunrise, We'll go for up to 8-9 hours a day. We stop for water. We stop if we've got somebody sick with us or whatever. It varies, but I mean, we're walking in very hot conditions. Now it's 45 to 50 degrees in Afar region. It's the hottest inhabited region in the world. But your body learns to cope with that. I mean, apparently my body's learned to cope. I'm extraordinarily healthy and I thank God for that. I can live on minimal water, and I can also live on minimal food. That's not too difficult for me.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. Our guest is Valerie Browning, author of Malika, My Life Among the Afar Nomads of Africa. Valerie has given herself to a life living as an Afar with the Afar. Valerie, let's go back to your first encounter with Ethiopia. I mentioned in the introduction that you first encountered the country, as many of us did, through those remarkable images that Jonathan Dimbleby sent back of the Ethiopian famine in the 1970s. That got you caught up in a way that became a surprise to you, in fact. You were a young youth leader at St. Barnabas Church, one of Sydney's best-known Anglican churches in Broadway, and had just qualified as a nurse. Tell us about your life then and what led you to Ethiopia.
That's quite right. I had a friend who's still here and still a friend of mine, Rowene, and she had put my name to a list of people to go to Ethiopia to help with that famine. Her friend's father was the director of the then Sudan Interior Mission, and they were looking for Australian nurses to go. She gave him my name and her name. I was not very happy with that at all, that my name had been given. That cut short. Within 10 days, we were gone. So there was no preparation. There was no decision on my part. Yes, let me go and help these people. I probably would have been quite happy to have given money. That would have not been a problem to me, I don't think.
So what motivated you to go, to make the decision to go rather than say, no, take me off the list?
Well, eventually I did disgruntledly go because I thought she was doing something utterly foolish. She was my friend. I didn't want to hurt. And I thought, well, at least it's only going to be 3 months and I'll stay with her, I'll help her. And, you know, she's all burning to go, not me. And at least I can help her. And, yeah, I was thinking that I was protectionist, I suppose, for her. But, yeah, as it was, we stayed 6 months. And as you say, had our minds totally changed.
Well, you had a bit of a confrontation with your faith as well. I mean, coming out of the Sydney Anglican environment, it was a very evangelical environment, particularly St. Barnabas Broadway, yet you encountered a sort of Christian mission in Ethiopia, the group you were working for, which caused you to rethink your whole attitude to mission, ultimately.
Indeed. In fact, the mission in Ethiopia then didn't understand the African people or the people of Ethiopia at all, and I found that utterly absurd. I was, as a girl, quite fun-loving, and I loved jokes, I loved to play cards, that sort of thing. I loved to be with people and in communication, and the mission constantly held me up to task and said I was fraternizing with local people. And I said, what do you mean by this? What's the problem? I mean, we're just friends. And they said, this is not possible because you must know yourself that Africans have half the intellect to Western people. And I was just flabbergasted that they would, you know, that they would conceive such thinking. Then after that was the first instant. The second instant was when I'd been in Sudan for 2 years working with the refugees, I decided to go back to Australia via Ethiopia. So I got a visa into Ethiopia for 5 days to find information about how that socialist regime had killed so many youth in 1978 and also persecuted Christians in the south of Ethiopia. And in Addis Ababa in those 5 days, I went back to the mission and I said to them, now, what is it about all these Christian churches and these Christian leaders who've been killed in the south of Ethiopia. And they said, oh, that's excellent. That's really excellent, because by suffering, their Christian faith will grow. I said, but what are you doing about it? Are you talking about it? Are you telling the world community about these terrible atrocities? They said, oh, no, we're not. And you shouldn't, because by the fire, you know, the spirit grows in people. I was again flabbergasted, and they told me how they'd found a body load of children's bodies outside the gate of the mission and told nobody. So I flew to London, I flew to Amnesty International in London and gave them all the lists of the human rights violations that I had recorded, and went to the BBC and told the BBC. And when I was in the BBC studio, one of their members from the mission rang from Sweden, from Stockholm, and she said, I'm so glad that you've reported this, because the mission forbade us. We wanted to tell the world how cruel these people were and that the Christian church was suffering so much. And they said it should not be broadcast by mission members. And this for me was unchristian. It was not the way we as Christians should behave one to another. We should be loving to one to another. We should be caring. And I didn't understand that.
It was also about the way those Christians saw themselves in relation to the rest of the world and to the people to whom they were ministering. You express a concern that, they looked down on the people they were ministering. It was almost a sense of charity towards a poor benighted folk who were to disappear from the earth. But there's another sense there in which the Christians had an inadequate understanding of their role in the world as agents of justice.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Because I said to the mission, "Why? What will you lose? You all have homes in America, in Canada, and so on. Why didn't you tell the international media? Why didn't you explain? I mean, you don't lose anything. You can still go to your place." They said, no. We don't want the mission closed here. Mm. I mean, it's as if the Christians of Ethiopia could not do without the mission. Well, that's rubbish. I mean, the local people can run their own affairs very nicely, and they may have suffered less if there was more publicity, I think.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. We're talking with Valerie Browning, an Australian known to the people of the Afar region of the Horn of Africa as Malika, a life given to the service of others. Valerie, a little music now from Ethiopia, another piece from the CD that you've brought to share with us from Hussein Haile, and it's Indigana. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, this is an Afar song again, and they're talking about how they want to retain their culture, how they want to retain their traditions, even in the changing world. They don't want to, as it were, throw out the baby with the bathwater. And this is a young boy. Hussein is very young, and he's singing like this. And to me, this is very inspiring.
Indigana. Takina ukana taukem, la minyo hani bakani alachin, la ina kani etalachin. Ay 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 ay, nee nee nee. Yisunani hal karisa, o hayo kete makta. Yok mabul kot kahuma.
Oh,
You're on Sunday Night. John Cleary with you, my guest, Valerie Browning. Her biography, Malika, My Life Among the Afar Nomads of Africa, has just been published. Valerie Browning in conjunction with John Little, and it's published by Macmillan. Valerie, you talked a little bit about your faith in the context of Africa. Let's continue that for a moment and move on to your work as an agent of development in Africa, because it's linked to the way you see your faith. You mentioned just before that music that the Ethiopians are quite capable of looking after themselves, that Christian missions tended to see themselves as sort of visitors who flew in, lived in sort of almost isolated from the rest of the community. And the key for you to this change almost begins when you set foot in Africa. You mentioned making friends with local people and being remonstrated with by the missionaries for doing so. Yet those local people are the church. They are who Christianity is and what Christianity is in that country. You refer to your reluctance to see Christianity as something of preaching and more of something of living.
Yes, that's right. I think Christianity is completely life itself. So it's living and it's relating to people. I live now with the Afar community. Obviously, I don't have a church. Obviously, I don't have a minister, a pastor who's teaching me. Yeah, that means I'm denied something. But I have also this incredible privilege and this amazing relationship with these people who, through this, I learn more of my Christianity and my response. And I think that we can't limit God. And I think that in human terms, we try every time to limit him to kind of like a format, you know. And that's really funny, because I think God is the master of the whole universe and the master of all humanity and the one who will decide our future. So, I mean, how things should be, we shouldn't try and determine. And I think in many ways, there are people, and I've seen people in the Afar society who are more in line with God than many people in a Western society. They've got more sense of morality. They've got more sense of ethic. They've got more sense of God himself and thanking God and relating to God, you know? Yes.
Was it this understanding that actually in part informed your capacity to become part of the Afar yourself?
Perhaps, but again, I mean, the preacher said the Spirit moves in marvellous ways. Well, that's true. I mean, we don't know how God works, but I mean, I didn't choose my husband. I can't say I did. I don't even say that I honestly fell in love with my husband, but I know that God wants my marriage, and I know that God has a purpose for Afar, an absolute purpose in his incredible plan. So I can't deny any of that. So, yeah, I can only live in contentment, and I'm kept by God with amazing health, with amazing provision. You know, I'm not saying provision in the physical sense. I'm not wanting for anything, and yet I have not much. But I don't want anything, because I've learned that all those attachments of materialism, I suppose it is, it has no point in the end.
Yes, but you met your husband long after you'd been in Ethiopia. I mean, you got there in 73. You didn't marry till 1989, so you'd already become part of the culture, in a sense, before you met that profoundly determinative influence of your husband.
That's true. But I think that the life road is long and winding. And I think that I've been through many, many learning processes. I worked a year in Saudi Arabia. I've been through Somalia. I've been 2 years way back in a refugee camp in Sudan. And I think that all life is one amazing lesson. Huh? And everywhere along the line, I've been prepared more and more for what I have now, I think.
Let's talk a little about what you're doing now. Your commitment led you to establish an association, a pastoral association, which is a community development association for people, and that's what keeps you on the road. You're involved both in medical work and developmental work. Give us some idea of the extent of your agency's operations.
Well, firstly, to say that this organisation started extraordinarily small, just a little band of people voluntarily working in a situation where the AFA had no health or education at all. So there was no vaccination, no medicine, no nothing, and nobody could read and write. We have come from that in 1994 till today, where we have over 700 community-trained field workers, all of them working and making changes in their own communities. So we've got health workers, community teachers, women extension workers, and we've trained well over 500 traditional birth attendants. Around that health, education and women package, we do rainwater harvesting. The community construct roads, feeder roads. We also do environmental work, and we are also helping the community to understand the market. The Afar, as illiterate people, are outside the cash economy of Ethiopia, which means that the assets they have, their animals, are not useful to them. So we're helping them to do community marketing, to work as a community in associations, to improve their household economy. And we're working also to help them fight drought and disease. Last year, for 2007, almost the entire year, we battled outbreaks of what the government described as acute watery diarrhea. In fact, it was an outbreak of cholera. And we went on and on battling it in 18 districts of the Afar region. And yes, it's now a widespread organisation, totally community-based, working in 50%, roughly 50% of the population.
What's interesting about that is the model you use. The model you use doesn't seek to go in and impose on people and say, now you've got to change this, you've got to change that. In order to be healthy, you've got to do this. You work on a model which starts with the community themselves and what their customs and their laws are, and you look for a way through those laws rather than a way to change those laws.
Absolutely, because in any traditional laws and in any traditional beliefs, there are wonderful, wonderful things that have been lost to the knowledge of Western people through technology. And so we want to build up what they have, strengthen what they have, and thus we use the illiterate people themselves, give them literacy and then train them as the community workers. So they are empowering their own people.
And you use local customs. So if there is a local taboo you can take advantage of, you take advantage of that taboo.
Absolutely. We also work through Islam, because Islam is a religion of peace. It's also a religion of health. There are things in the teachings of Islam about hygiene, about giving women rights and so on, which the Afar don't understand. And if you tell them that, you know, the fact that they have forced a young girl into marriage is against Islam, they're very badly shocked. And then they want to give her her rights. And so, yeah.
It's come down to things like genital mutilation as well.
Absolutely. Female genital mutilation, the Afar thought it was Islam dictating to them to do it. In fact, it's not. In fact, there are 3-4 places in Islamic teaching which says that it should not be done. And it to not do anything, not to touch the young girl when she's born, the baby, is quite acceptable to Islam. And so now we've employed two sheikhs in the program, and they're excellent. They're very good mobilizers, and they're very outspoken, and they help the local sheikhs to, you know, really get active. Mm. And so, in fact, yes, we mobilize all the positive things within their religion, within their customs, within their traditions, so that they can use those to improve their well-being.
Now, just how would you do that? Would you go out into a village and you would you say seek out the local sheikh or the local headman and bring them in and give them a sort of cultural education, or would you unpack it? I mean, there has to be a very practical way, because your agenda is so large, in which going into a remote village or with a remote community or on the move every 3 months or 4 months, I mean, how do you do it practically?
Well, we know geographic areas that we're covering, and we know what topics have gone where. We have a harmful practices awareness team. They have local films. We make local films. They go out with a generator, and they go out with a laser projector. And so they can run film shows in the bush with the people. And whoever comes to that, I mean, the sheikh will come to that film showing, the clan elder will come, and the traditional association leader will come. So these are the top leaders of the community who are seeing this film and discussing the problems within the film with the community. So it's totally community-based discussion. We're not taking them away from their environment for the discussion. And then we're asking them what they want to do. If they want to set up a group of people who are going to act on it, then we do that. Huh? And then we help these people to go on to see. And then, for example, we've used the example of female genital mutilation. Within the community, we will find all the women who are practicing it and help them to say, well, you know, they are against their religious belief. They are, as the sheikh says, with the blood of children on their hands. And so they immediately see the horror of that, and they give it up. They swear that they will never do it again. They ask the forgiveness of God. So, I mean, we connect it to people personally. We connect it. They know the problems that they're facing through female genital mutilation. They've seen the suffering of girls. They've seen the suffering of women. They know the number of women who die in childbirth. And so it's empowering the people to just act on what they know.
You describe going out with a projector and being able to do that. But quite often the sorts of things you are doing, if it's perhaps delivering vaccinations or other medical equipment, can be a little more complicated than that. There is one anecdote in your book of you having to trek along the road yourself. You had vaccines which were needed to be kept cool. You're out in 50 degree temperatures, and you're on foot, and you fell over and injured your ankle. Just take us through that anecdote, just to give us some idea that this isn't just going out there in the Land Rover and doing the right thing.
No, it's not. I mean, it's a very difficult terrain in many, many parts to walk through. And that was a trip I did to Mumbai. And partway, stupidly, I didn't look properly. I turned my ankle right over. It was extremely painful. But realizing that I'm with a group of health workers, we can't all sit down and cry on the rock together. There's no point. So, yeah, you've got to put on your best stoic face, I suppose, and push that foot down. And I found with pushing it down, I could get rid of some of the pain.
Now, you were a long way from anywhere on this. How long had you been walking when this happened to you?
We'd been walking about 8 hours, and we had another 4 to go. Yeah.
And the vaccines had to be kept cool. They were in ice. So you couldn't just pause and let them melt. Let the ice melt.
No way, no way. And the vaccines are, I mean, every vaccine ampoule is for 10 children. So it's 10 children's chance that you've spoiled, and you've got, you know, several hundred vaccines on the back of the camel. So no.
So you just had to tell the rest to leave you there and come back and pick you up on the way back?
No, I went on. I pushed on. I pushed on. I was not I was the back of the line. When I got to the place where we were able to sit down, then I had searing pain, And they've always got local treatment. So immediately they found somebody who could massage my leg and foot for me. He did that. And in fact, the pain got worse. I didn't want to tell him that. And then because we didn't think the ice was going to last, we sent immediately one camel back through the night. And unfortunately, that fellow took the report that I'd actually broken a bone. I mean, crazy boy. And so that reached all the way to my husband, all the way to the regional president. And they were discussing together, I mean, how on earth they were going to get into a place which had no road access to get me out. And Ismail said, I think they'll just tie her to a camel and bring her back. But nevertheless, the provision of God again, if you have faith. I got better. I got better, and I was able to go again the next morning. Yeah.
You were able to walk out.
Yeah.
Valerie Browning is our guest on Sunday night. A remarkable life with the Afar people as Malika. Another piece of music now, Valerie. Kale Wirasul, what's this about?
This, again, is about the way the Afar need to. They've struggled through so many different political issues, and now they need to be united as one people, and they need to come through all the problems that they have to have development, to go on to be one people. Afar, as you said, are living over three countries, and their aspirations are together.
Kale Wirasul.
بقول مبطيوك وانك حنيوك يملكي عنك عدوايتي تك هم بقول مبطيوك وانك حنيوك يملكي كل رسول روكة كل رسول روكة رفت ما بكوكي كلا وانا يكحل يبيعكر رفت ما بكوكيك انا وانا يكحل يبيعك Thank you.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Our guest is Valerie Browning. Valerie, we can't go any further without alluding to your family connections here in Australia, because many people will know members of your family, even if they're unaware of it. Your brother is, in fact, George Browning, the Anglican bishop of Canberra, known to many, and an active environmentalist, a chair of the Archbishop of Canterbury's Anglican Environmental Organisation. Here is a connection between yourself and the world, not just personally, but something that enables you to use a wider network to serve the interests you have. We'll talk about that in a moment, but how did your family react to your journey, particularly being married to a Muslim man, having two children who you bring up as what, Muslims or Christians?
Well, my oldest is Aisha. She's 17, and she's made a decision to be Christian, actually. She decided around about the age of 10, 12 to be Christian. My boy, Ramid, is 6. He's young, and how he'll choose his life, I don't know.
And this is not a problem for your husband, Ishmael?
Not at all. His problem is if somebody says, there is no God, I don't believe in God. That's his problem. He says, I can't fathom that one out. So he appreciates Christianity. He appreciates the Jewish faith as well as his own.
And what about back here in Australia, when you return to the bosom of your Australian family? Your background was a fairly conservative Anglican background. You have a brother who's a bishop. Your father, late in life, became an Anglican priest. You have other members of your 8 siblings in the medical profession. How did they react to your commitment?
Well, by the time I married, I was not young by any means, but I was...
They were probably saying, thank the Lord, she's finally decided.
Yeah, that's what my mother said. We've been looking for that little ring on your hand, dear, she said as I came back in the house and said, yeah, I am married. I said, now you go and tell my father. They were very loving, and I appreciate that. I realise that my family have had to literally put up and maybe shut up when it's in the case of me, because, I mean, I was always trekking off. I was always going to the same place, to the Horn. As my brother George said, somehow the Horn took me. But, yeah, I mean, I think that my family have been enormously loving and enormously accepting of me as still their daughter and their sister, despite all I am.
I imagine you're able to contribute to their lives enormously just by the fact of who you are and what you do. When you sit down and talk with your brother, George, he's got absolute commitment to many of the same issues but expressed in quite a different way. What are the issues you want to get into his ear about?
Well, it's about people's rights and their rights as nationalities, their rights as people to exist, because this is what it seems like. It seems like there are certain people expendable or squeezed off the planet. And my husband has discussed with George a lot on the Christian church. He asked him how the Christian church became from a community church, as it seems to be in the Bible, to being such an institution with such hierarchy and so on and so on. And so there's a lot of discussion going on between us as a family. And we have George has a great appreciation for Ishmael, and they have a great conversation together every time they meet. And on issue, yes, George is very keen on the environment, and he's right. The basis of it all is Mother Planet. And Mother Planet is terribly, terribly important for the Afar, as for anybody.
And indeed, one of the crucibles for the environmental movement has to be the degradation of regions like the Afar, where they are dry as they are drying out even more and can make life for the Afar almost impossible. I mean, climate change is a real fact for Ethiopia, and it was one of the first bellwethers.
Indeed. I mean, we've faced since 1999 now, I think it's 6 droughts. It's quite awful. And again, we've got some crazy behaviour going on where still our federal government is thinking that irrigation farming is the best way to go. They've taken just now 60,000 hectares of Awash River Basin, which is the best land for the Afar, the riverside land for the Afar, the only riverside land for sugarcane plantation for ethanol fuel. You see, and this is outside of the Afar interest entirely.
Well, it can destroy the Afar community in a way.
Yeah, I mean, you've got people who never knew the word thirst in their entire history are now talking of thirst, and they live by the Awash River. The Awash River is diverted for other reasons, is dammed up for other reasons. So, I mean, it would seem that our third world countries are pushed into short-term gains rather than seeing the long-term, rather than seeing the environmental issues, rather than seeing the whole thing in a perspective. And this is very sad, I think. And I don't think it's at all helpful. And at the moment, there is nothing much to be said, I don't think, for what we can do.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of the Afar?
I think that every person who learns literacy, every person who is empowered by the program, every woman who takes it in her hands to demand safe motherhood is more than just another light. They're going to generate more and more people. I have hope that the Afar will survive if we work harder and we work with better resources as a viable people.
Can that nomadic life survive, that nomadic pastoral life survive, and should it survive?
It is the way of life which is absolutely perfect for that part of the world. Pastoralist way of life is absolutely ecologically right. Farming is not. Irrigation farming is not. And if it is allowed to survive, and not more than just survive, to grow in its sustainability, then it can help other areas that are dry land. It can help other areas of Ethiopia and other areas. I mean, it's just so awful that pastoralist people internationally have had to be under the thumb. You've got the Mongolians, you've got people in Kenya, you've got all over the place, where the pastoralist people have been seen as less than civilized, less than developed, and therefore they should not be part of development systems. And this is just so awful. And I think we could learn so much about how to preserve the planet from these people. They are the most perfect ecologists. They do not exploit the land resource. They move to contain and retain the land resource, the resource of grazing, the resource of water. They know the environment so well. They know the climatic situations, the meteorology of their own land so very, very well. And yet outsiders keep coming in and saying, oh no, we have the system, you know, these people must move, they must settle, they must do this. And it's just really quite frightening in that respect. So or if more power goes to the people and they do it themselves, I think we can win.
Valerie Browning, great to speak with you. We wish you and Ismail well and your family as you return to Ethiopia. Let's finish with an optimistic song, but from a different culture again. This is Tracy Chapman talking about a revolution. Why have you chosen a song like this?
Because I love Tracy Chapman. I think she's the greatest, man. She expresses herself, and the Western people don't often.
Tracy Chapman, talking about a revolution. A little theme to go out on with Valerie Browning. Valerie, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Really, John, thank you. It's been a great discussion.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds... Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds. People gonna rise up and get their share. we're gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying to those observers, armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution.